Good afternoon and welcome to another episode of Pritzker Military Presents on the Home Front. My name is Dr. Rob Havers, the President and CEO of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. And today I am delighted to be joined by Dr. Michael Nyberg, Chair of the Department of War Studies and Professor of History, United States Army War College. Dr. Nyberg joins us today for the fifth episode of our new web series. This series is a way to keep connected to our constituents and the military history community at large while we continue to work remotely. Each episode of this series will be recorded off-site. Before we begin, I would like to take a moment to thank our members and our donors for their support, the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. It is because of you that we can continue the work of educating the public about military history and military affairs. Important lessons can be learned by exploring history through the lens of military affairs, and we are proud to be a part of your exploration. In today's episode, we look back at the 1918-1919 Spanish flu pandemic, which until recently was the most severe pandemic in modern history. Today, Michael Nyberg and I will talk a little bit about this pandemic, its historical implications for the modern world. Dr. Nyberg is the author of many books on the First and Second World Wars, including The Path to Freedom, How the First World War Created Modern America, The Blood of Free Men, The Liberation of Paris, 1944, and Dance of the Furies, Europe and the Outbreak of World War I. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Pritzker Military Presents. Almost as soon as the COVID-19 virus started to spread throughout Southeast Asia and move to other parts of the world, the media, historians, and public health officials started to make comparisons with the Spanish flu of 1918, which killed an estimated 50 million worldwide. The virus itself took 675,000 American lives, nearly six times the number of American lives lost in combat during all of World War I. So, Dr. Nyberg, I'd like to start off our discussion today, perhaps by finding out how exactly it was that the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918 and 1919 became known as the Spanish flu.
Good afternoon. Thanks, Dr. Havers, for putting this all together. It's actually a funny story. The Spanish flu has very little to do with Spain. The only reason it's known as the Spanish flu is that the influenza epidemic began during the First World War. Spain, being neutral, did not censor its newspapers. So France, Germany, Britain, Austria all wanted to keep news of the influenza out of their media because they were afraid that the other side might learn how bad the influenza was affecting them. Spain didn't have this problem. There was also a prominent member of the Spanish royal family who had the Spanish flu, had the disease. And so we call it the Spanish flu, even though it really has nothing to do specifically with Spain at all.
Very interesting. So very much a disease of its time in terms of how it's known today. What were some of the symptoms of the Spanish flu of that period?
Awful. Doctors report just terrible, terrible symptoms. Blood shooting out of people's ears and noses. It produced pneumonia. It produced a condition where the blood simply wasn't delivering oxygen so that people's skins would turn blue. Just really awful coughing, awful diseases. And influenza could kill people. You could catch it in the morning and be dead by the evening. So it also had this very dramatic, powerful impact. It also, unusually for influenza epidemics like this, it targeted young people. It didn't just target the very young and the very old, which is what a lot of influenza epidemics do. This one targeted young people, so that age group was facing both military service and facing a particular susceptibility to influenza. So it was just a terrible combination of events.
The casualty totals of this pandemic 100 years ago, startling. To what extent, Dr. Nyberg, would you say that the susceptibility of the various populaces around the world were greater because of the impact of 4 years of war.
There's no doubt, both because public health in general was degraded, importantly, not just because you're bringing all of these people together in unsanitary conditions, but also because you're taking doctors and nurses out of the civilian sphere and you're putting them into the military sphere so that those resources were not available in communities to kind of get a handle on this disease quickly. And of course, because of the movement globally of people, we think this one probably began in Kansas. And then the dispatch of American soldiers worldwide, of course, makes this disease move very, very quickly. So there's both a degrading of public health in general, and there's a lack of resources because those resources are being diverted into military service. So again, it's a perfect storm. It's every bad thing you can possibly imagine all coming together at one point.
It's quite interesting to look back from our sort of current vantage point. I tend to think that the contemporary connectivity of our modern globalized world, our globalized economy, has undoubtedly contributed to the spread of this COVID-19 pandemic with which we are grappling right now, and that therefore it is unusually swift in encircling the planet. But ironically, 100 years ago, because of the prototypical movement of people around the world on a large scale for World War I, those same situations are somewhat replicated.
Absolutely. In fact, I was just reading something recently, a new economic estimate, that argued that the world didn't get back to 1913 levels of globalization until China opened up in the early 1990s. So even before World War I, you had this widely connected globalized world where you didn't really need passports, you didn't need a lot of government checks in order to go from point A to point B around the globe. You take that environment and then you multiply it exponentially with the movement of not just men, but of course horses and pigs and sheep and all kinds of things around the world. And you get this epidemiological environment that again is uniquely susceptible to the spread of a disease like this one.
Some of the debate about the way in which this has been handled has centered on different nations' responses to what we're dealing with now. So you have some countries that are very forcibly locked down with a lot of restrictions, and you have at the other end of the spectrum, the Swedish example, who seem to be taking a very much a laissez-faire approach to it. And in part, this seems to be because different nations have understood or seen different impacts on their own society of this disease. Back in 1918, how swiftly did individual countries respond? And also, at what point was there a consensus as to this is actually a pandemic that transcends national borders and isn't localized? Was it a swift response by comparison, or was it quite slow?
Part of it depends upon whether the country in question was involved in the war or not. So in the United States, there was a conscious decision made by Peyton Marsh, the commander-in-chief, the chief of staff of the United States Army, to dispatch soldiers to Europe without quarantining them for a week before. So the medical people wanted all American soldiers quarantined for 1 week and then sent to France, just to so they could eliminate those that were symptomatic and reduce the impact of the flu virus on the force in Europe. Peyton Marsh, backed by President Wilson, made the decision not to do that because they believed getting those soldiers over to Europe was a greater need than quarantining them and trying to reduce the risk of flu in the United States. So I think that's one example. The other is what social scientists call path dependency, which is just a fancy term to say you do whatever you're set up to do already. So in a country like India, where the British Empire ruled parts of it and the so-called princely states ruled other parts, there was no central authority that really could take over and do something like this. There were other cases, usually smaller places, places with a little bit more geographic control. Newfoundland is the classic example where they had a very active, very well-functioning public health system. They were able to shut things down very, very quickly, and as a result, be affected relatively less. So part of it depended on circumstance and part of it depended upon the kinds of structures in place. As we're seeing today here in 2020, if you don't have the capability, it's very, very difficult just to create it if one doesn't already exist inside the system.
Yes, indeed. What lessons would you say can be learned, Dr. Nyberg, from, I think we would both agree that there always is always much to be learned from a study of history. Anything specific, looking back at the pandemic of 1819, that might be usefully employed today?
I'm always struck by a comment made by a British general that I was in a briefing with, and he began by saying, the thing we must always remember is that history is not done with us. And what that means to me is it is incumbent upon leaders, this is a very, very difficult thing to look into the future. It's very, very hard to plan for those things that have not happened. But it is incumbent upon leaders, it is incumbent upon institutions at all levels to be thinking about what one would do if something like this were to come back. What capabilities would you want to have in place? What people would you want to have in place? How would you want them trained? And then to find ways to dedicate resources to that. My wife's closest friend from childhood works for a center at Johns Hopkins University that is specifically dedicated to this, and this has been in existence for years. She's been obviously very busy. I haven't been able to catch up with her too much, but the center was created exactly for this. So the question would be, where should those resources be located? Should they be at the state level? Should they be at the national level? Or should it be something like the World Health Organization that coordinates this globally? Because by definition, these pandemics don't care about state or national boundaries. So what I would hope once we recover from this, and maybe even before we're recovered from this, is to start to think about what are those capabilities that we didn't have? At what level should these capabilities be available? And what are we missing that we ought to have? And the example I've been thinking about is the World War II example, when the United States started to think about the GI Bill and started to think about reemployment of veterans while the war was still going on. So hopefully there are people at levels of government that are beginning to think already, what are the things we wished we'd had and where do we wish we'd had them? And then begin to think about ways to pre-plan for the next one. But as I said, it's extremely difficult, both because the size and scale of the influenza epidemic then and COVID now is just simply impossible to plan for in the way that they've hit. But we need to start thinking about the things that maybe we should have had on hand and start to prepare for the future.
We talked a little bit about how the fact of World War I, the First World War, facilitated the spread of the disease. What was the impact of the disease on the conduct of the war, and when did it become apparent at what point in the war did it become apparent in the armies of the belligerent powers?
This is really important too. It's really impossible to understand. It's impossible to separate out the history of the flu from the history of the war. So it really begins to become obvious that you're dealing with a pandemic. You're dealing with something. You're at that what they call that Wile E. Coyote moment, where you realize there is nothing underneath you. There's nothing protecting you. That moment starts to come in about September 1918. And it's just at the moment when the real critical moment of the war is approaching, when the Allies are beginning also to awaken to the fact that if they do this right, they have a chance to win the war in 1918 and not risk it going into 1919. It's happening at this very, very crucial moment. What we think that means is that it impacts the number of soldiers that are available to both sides, quite obviously, but that it may well have had some larger strategic impacts, not least of which the German decision not to move as many men from the Russian front over to the Western. We think that that may have been influenced in part by the fear that there were too many men with influenza in the East and not wanting to move those men through Germany and through the home country, if you will, the home front. We also think it probably impacted Germany's operational capability, because Germany at that point was really being hit very badly by the British and French and American, by that point, blockade, and that health conditions inside the German army were probably worse than they were in other places. I don't know that we have enough evidence to suggest it, but there's also some at least speculation that something similar is happening inside the Ottoman Empire's army. So while it's hitting everybody, the victorious allies, which are materially a little bit better and morally a little bit better, may have been able to cushion some of this. If I may, there's also an impact on the American army that is also a bit speculative, but I think more and more historians are coming to agree on. There was this phenomenon in September, October, in the Battle of the Meuse-Argonne, which was then the largest battle the American army had ever fought, there was this problem the army didn't know what to do with, where men would just they called it straggling. Men would just wander away for 3 or 4 days from their units and then come back. And the army really didn't know what to do. You can't shoot everybody that's doing this with desertion, and you can't really find a way to force back. What we think now is that it may have been the case that a lot of these men had influenza and just simply needed to get away, sleep, let the disease either move through them or find a hospital or something like that. So we now think that some of that straggler phenomenon might well have been related to men not wanting to report to the formal medical or disciplinary system and just going away to try to sleep it off for a couple of days. Again, the evidence is not perfectly conclusive on this, but it seems like a logical conclusion.
I'm going to veer into the sort of speculative realm a little bit. It's interesting that had this obviously this pandemic in 1819 would have not approached the scale it did were it not for the facilitating elements of World War One. But it's almost a footnote to that terrible 4 years of conflict that everybody thinks about beginning of the 20th century. Is there a secret history of World War One to be written with the pandemic, the flu pandemic in mind, that brings out these pieces that you have suggested here, Dr. Nyberg, that the Germans are reluctant to transfer reinforcements, that U.S. efforts at the Meuse-Argonne perhaps are undermined by the impact of the flu that weren't really recognized at the time?
It sure is. I just the question would be the source material. So the frustrating thing for an historian is that every army records things like flu cases differently. So some armies may just record them all as sick. Some might record them as sick, cause unknown. Some might specifically speculate that this is influenza. So comparisons are hard to do. And for the most part, censorship made it so that men couldn't talk about the flu in their letters and in their diaries and things like that. So it would be difficult. A lot of our German stuff that we think is based on the observations of Erich Ludendorff, one of the commanders in the German army, senior commanders in the German army, and he certainly had an incentive to blame the flu and not his own really bad command and decision making for the collapse of the German army at the end of the war. So it would be there. I haven't seen the sources yet that would make me as a professional historian comfortable to make some of these statements definitively, but that doesn't mean that the sources aren't out there and we just need to go out and find them. I would also think that after this corona COVID crisis that we're going through, people will start to take the influenza much more seriously, not just as a footnote, as you said, but understand it integrally as part of the history of this period.
Yes, absolutely. I think one of the interesting things too that has struck me is this may be a product of the lack of reluctance on the part of senior leaders, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, Angela Merkel, for example, to come forward and say, yes, I am exhibiting symptoms of coronavirus, I will self-isolate, I've been tested, I have the virus. This contrasts markedly with the behavior of several leaders, prominent leaders, 100 years ago. David Lloyd George, British Prime Minister, mm-hmm. keeps his infection secret. Wilson too, Pershing as well. What does that say about the respective times we live in and the times that these individuals led? Or is that simply a function of the war?
I think it's partly a function of the war. Wilson, we know, had at least one bout of influenza. Some suspect he might have had a second one as well. Some folks suspect that some of the health problems he had after were in fact side effects of influenza and maybe not even a stroke, which has always been what we've assumed in the post-war period when he's campaigning for the Treaty of Versailles. A lot of it, I think, has to do with the war and trying to keep some of this information secret. Don't let people know just how bad this is hitting the armies, or don't let people know that it's hitting the commanders. Part of it, I think, also, you know, we're able to do what we're able to do because the technology has also changed. So a person can self-isolate, a leader can self-isolate now, and nevertheless still be in control of the things that he or she needs to be in control of. This is a little bit different in the 1918-1919 time period. So I'm actually a little bit amazed at the way that, you know, the Pritzker and other organizations have been able to go on and keep doing the things that they need to do my organization as well. And that's been partly technological. So I think it's a little of both, but I think it's primarily the war, and it's primarily people like Pershing, Peyton Marsh, Wilson, the American side, Ludendorff on the German side, just trying to guard information and protect, prevent it from getting out for something that military people today would call operational security reasons.
I'm sure everybody is has been struck by the U.S. military response to the pandemic. The U.S. Navy, the Army Corps of Engineers, Navy sending hospital ships, Corps of Engineers setting up emergency hospitals. There's a comforting element to see the military involved. I think for most people, they know the military gets the job done, and they are good under pressure. How do militaries have they responded in the past to pandemics, and what sort of special planning has gone into that?
There's actually been a lot of success out of the Ebola crisis from a few years ago that the military has studied. There are issues in the United States, again, that path dependency that I talked about. In the United States, there is a formal process known as DISCA, Defense Support to Civil Authorities. There are legal codes that govern what the military can do inside America's borders and what it can't do. So it's actually a little bit easier if you're thinking about something like Ebola to set up an operation overseas than it is to do it at home. So this has been a situation where the emergency has led to some red tape getting lifted. But a lot of this, at least in my experience with students of mine and colleagues of mine who have been involved in this end for the military, has been involved in thinking through very carefully what DISCA means, how to function in a DISCA environment, and the lessons learned from Ebola, which again, seems to have been a pretty good success about figuring out what capabilities you the military uniquely had that you could use, and what things you didn't want to duplicate or step on civilian authorities that could do that capability as well or better than you could. So it's not just in the U.S. military. I was just talking to a German friend yesterday in the German Army. They've been doing remarkable things. The French Army set up a field hospital in Mulhouse in eastern France. So it is, as you said, the militaries typically are, especially in the United States case, they are well-resourced. They have a lot of smart, dedicated, highly trained professional people. So it's an institution that you would want involved, and there is a system for it. It's just one of those things, again, that you want to make sure that you're studying and thinking about, and the Ebola case has been one that we've been able to learn an awful lot of good lessons from.
Good points well made, and I'd like to get a plug in for my previous employer of many years ago, the British Army, who's done something very similar across the UK. So, Dr. Nyberg, you teach strategy, obviously, at the Army War College. How does a military maintain its operational readiness while directly combating a pandemic in their troops?
Well, this is a really, really difficult thing, quite obviously. This is not something that, we talk about the difference between strategy, which is something that you can develop before something happens, and then crisis management, which is response to something that you weren't expecting. This is obviously crisis management. One way that you can do this, of course, if you're in a multinational system like NATO or the series of alliances and systems of alliances that the Western states are in, you can rely on one another. So Germany and France, for example, have been moving people between the two countries. So from places that are overloaded in their healthcare capacity to places that have additional capacity and additional capability. You can rely on the kind of blend of military and civil to hopefully patch up some of the things that you need to do. This will be another case study that I'm sure we'll be looking at here. How did people make these decisions? How did you balance the risk to your force versus the risk for training? And I know it's training that is the worry right now, because training obviously, almost by definition, requires bringing a lot of people together in a situation that needs to be avoided right now. It's a lot of on-the-fly decisions. It's a lot of making sure that information is flowing from the bottom up and top down. And like I said, I hope that someone's capturing these lessons learned and someone is starting to capture what worked well and what didn't work well, so that we can have something to go back to when the next crisis hits.
And as much as the military is focused somewhat internally on providing aid to the civilian power, the military is, of course, mindful about external threats, because that's what the military is about, safeguarding the U.S. interests abroad and the homeland, while mitigating whatever's coming over the horizon. Dr. Nyberg, thank you very much for your wonderful insights on what is a fascinating piece of history and one that has really come home to us in recent months. Thank you all for tuning in to the fifth installment of Pritzker Military Presents on the home front. And as always, if you enjoyed this program, please be sure to visit our website for Dr. Nyberg's presentation of his most recent work entitled The Treaty of Versailles, A Concise History. As always, if you are looking for more engaging content, our website has a long list of free videos and programs on a host of thought-provoking topics. And if you are not a member of the museum and library already, please consider becoming one today. Our ability to put on programs like this at all times is down to your generosity. Thank you very much, and please join us again for Pritzker Military Presents on the home front.